Hi, I am Eli, and I'm the spirit animal of the USFT. And the person who claimed me was Craig Shipman.
Yeah, so, well, basically there are like a combination of smaller things that you could exploit if you end up facing Shenlong. He is scary. And I think that big kind of fear factor is one of the things that stop people from playing against him in an efficient manner.
Howdy, friends. We got a very interesting Path to Podium covering the Swedish Nationals from late last year. It was a very interesting format for a two-day event and a neat way to kind of handle Nationals with a qualifier the first day and then kind of a finals round robin the second day. You get to hear about the infamous Shenlong list that won the event and, for some, started the controversy around that master, along with the finish made by the same or similar list at the UK Nationals. At the end of the episode, we talk about some vulnerabilities in Shenlong that you may not hear people talking about, so that's worth a listen. It's really good hearing their approaches to corrupted idols and plant explosives, something I thought that was kind of unique. And last but not least, we get to talk about how good Insidious Madness are in idols. Oh, again, don't stick around to the end. We have a great discussion on the state of Arcanists, Rezzers, and the Ten Thunders as entire factions. All three guests make some really interesting points. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to three of the players from this year's Swedish Nationals event, and it was held in Sweden. The format of the event was very interesting. They had 14 players on day one, and they played three rounds. But what they did is a little unique. They then took the top four players from day one, and they moved them into a second round-robin, three-round event on day two. So basically, you had to qualify the first day to be one of the top four people, and then those top four people played each other, three games, one against each other, and then the player with the best record, the best highest victory points and the highest diff would end up winning the event. On the second day, the other 10 players then played in a second three-round event on the second day. So it's kind of the loser's bracket, for lack of a better term. Now, what's great about this is that, you end up with, in the second day, pairings are fixed because everybody gets to play each other if you've qualified for that top four. And then the person with the best record would end up, winning the event. If the two people had the same record, then they would go to victory points. And then if victory points were the same, they would go to who had the highest differential. What's really interesting is that the two gentlemen that ended up finishing highest tied. So not only did they have the same record, two wins, no losses, and a tie, but the tie is when they played each other. They both had the same victory points at 15 victory points, and they both had a +7 differential. We could spend a whole episode talking about how crazy it is that it worked out that way. But we're lucky because we have the two gentlemen that tied for first place on. So our first guest is Victor Forsberg. He's one of the co-winners. Victor, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thank you so much, and I'm very excited to be here.
No, it's good to have you, man. So, Victor, I asked this question of all guests on their first time on the show. How did you kind of find tabletop gaming and specifically Malifaux?
Yeah, so I started out with Warhammer 40K way back when I was younger and played that for a pretty long time with some friends. But then me and the same group of friends stumbled into Malifaux after like trying out some other games like War Machine and Warhammer Fantasy and so on a bit. And for me, it clicked like directly. It's a really great game. And it was, I think, in start of wave 2 in second edition. So like 5-6 years ago.
Yeah. So what was it that made it click so much, Victor? That what differentiated it from the other games that you tried playing?
I think mostly the like this sense of scoring with not only Wormer has always been like more killy focused, where in Malifaux you actually have the more scenario focused games, and also the bit smaller skirmish size felt nice.
Yeah, a little less pressure on the wallet, right?
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Well, congratulations on your tie. Now we're going to talk to our second guest, Joachim Abramson. Welcome to the Third Floor.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. So you tied Victor, both playing head-to-head with him as well as tying for the overall event itself. How did you come across Malifaux?
Well, I've always been into like video games and fantasy novels and things, but I didn't get into miniatures until I started university, and a friend of mine like roped me into actually Warhammer 40K as well. We were playing some sort of kill team slow grow league, and I started out with playing Eldar and had really fun time with the skirmish kind of game. I tried to like upgrade to go up in points and compete in regular games, but I didn't really think it was as fun as it was when there was more like in Kill Team, the focus on individual models and smaller moves. So when we came across Malifaux, actually pretty much around the same time as Victor, I suppose, Wave 2, it really clicked for me as well. I really liked the models, the aesthetic. I liked the really sneaky plays you could do with hidden schemes. And
yeah,
it's been so much fun.
It's funny that both you, Joachim, and Victor talk about, you know, the idea of the scheme pools and kind of the win conditions of Malifaux, which you're just now starting to see games kind of, not, I don't want to say steal, but be inspired by that concept. It amazes me it's taken this long, because I'm with both of you gentlemen that that was definitely one aspect of the game that made it feel different and definitely hooked me in. Now, our third guest is Andreas Soder. He didn't make the top four on that day, but he ended up doing very well on the second day event. Andreas and I have been chatting for, several months now. He and I connected on Facebook, and he actually helped me get both of these guys on the show. So, Andreas, welcome to the Third Floor.
Well, thank you, Craig. It's glad to be here.
Well, I feel like you and I have been buds for a while.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot. I mean,
yeah, a good bit.
We both had the same interest to make Malifaux more public, and have a public profile out.
Yeah, I agree. Now, Andreas, where are you like these gentlemen? Did you kind of find Malifaux via 40K?
I did. I started with 40K when I was about 10 years old with our homemade rules with my friends. It was terrible. But finally,
probably more balanced than the real rules, though.
I can't say that. It was over 15 years ago I played now. So, but again, I had the longest break and from tabletop, and I played Magic the Gathering for about 15 years. And then, I played pretty competitive and I played online and I played everywhere. I spent way too much money than I should have.
Yeah.
And then after I met my wife, I was scouting my local hobby store, and I was figuring we could paint some models together. So we picked up this cool looking box of Malifaux. So she picked the Lady Justice and I picked Pandora. So we painted it up and it looked nice and everything. And then I was I wonder what's the rule about this game. So I managed to get a demo game with a local player, and I fell in love with it first game.
That's great, man. That's great. It was the models that drew me in first too. I was playing Guild Ball at the time as part of my freedom from playing 40K, and I'd always had a thing for Weird West, and was kind of poking around looking at models, and yeah, the models hooked me. And then I started reading the rules. And once I got my first game in, it was over for me. Yeah. So guys, what we're going to do here is I'm going to try to find out from these gentlemen kind of, you know, what did they play? Who they played against, some of the big decisions and highlights from the games, and really get an idea from all three of them how they managed to end up with such strong performances, both in the main event and in the side event. So Joachim, can we talk about kind of day one? Now, I don't want to go round by round, but can you give me an idea of the three games, what masters you brought, and how those games went?
Yeah, sure. So I went into this tournament playing actually only Shenlong. I know there's been quite a bit of talk about him for good reason.
You're not helping that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm prepared for the shitstorm, if I might say so. but actually,
so you soloed him day one. That's the only keyword you played.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, both days.
Oh wow! So you played all six rounds.
Yeah, I did
with Shenlong. Now, day one, what were the? Do you remember the three keywords you played against?
At first I played against a local player called Alexander, who played the Neverborn Lucius. Actually,
nice.
And my second game was against another local player, Tom Elise, who played Colette. And my third and final game was actually against Andreas here, who played von Stuck.
Oh, wow. So that's interesting. So your first two were, you know, against some control type masters. Von Stuck's got a little bit of a mixture of that. Of the three, and don't let the fact that Andreas is on the show influence us, but what of the three matches, what was the kind of the biggest challenge?
Actually, I think all three games had like their own challenges. The first one ended with the closest score for a variety of reasons. But I actually, the third game against Andreas specifically, I was really worried about the game going into it. I had thought like tried to counterplay and strategize around meeting von Stuck for a long time.
Yeah.
So it was a really stressful game. It ended up going well for me, but I think that definitely was the hardest game.
So in the Neverborn faction, you don't hear a whole lot of talk about Lucius. Did you find that to be pretty effective?
Yeah, it's actually a really difficult keyword to properly evaluate, I think. I see a lot of potential there, and it was difficult to like keep in mind all of the different things he could be doing. So I do think that he could be quite good, but I would need to see a lot more play.
Yeah, I've only played against him in Guild. One of our local players, Jesse, is an excellent Lucius player, and there's a surprise because he can come at you in so many different ways. But I would be really curious, and hopefully at some point we'll cover it here on the podcast, to get a sense of, you know, what Lucius in a Neverborn group feels like. I don't have a sense how different that keyword is, in Guild versus Neverborn. Andreas, how about you? We know one of your matches was, day one, but, let's talk about the other two.
Yeah, so the first game I had was also against the same player, Colette, as Joachim had. That was a very stressful one. Like, I kind of knew what she was doing coming into it, and I played von Stuck, of course. But I didn't realize, like, how quick she was up the board.
Yeah.
And, like, how she pulled up her mannequins. Like he had double mannequins. He just pulled it up and just was in my deployment zone early turn two, mm-hmm. And I had to like he completely left the middle and just went on the flanks, and like I had to really really focus to stop him, and it was a really hard game because I had no idea what he was going to do.
Now with Colette, you have kind of two options from a metagame standpoint: either focus on her or ignore her. Which way did you go?
I totally ignored her. Like, yeah. I didn't. I just tried to touch everything I could because I know as soon as I was going to attempt to touch her. She was just going to be go away and pop up and do a nest of things to me.
So of the two of your, so you played Colette round one. What was your round two?
Round two was against Ten Thunders Misaki.
Ooh, nice.
And I was really worried about going into this one too, because I was worried I was going to meet Shenlong, but luckily he brought Misaki. Again, Misaki comes with her own tricks, so it's like it was a flank deployment, I believe it was, and when she just put out the shadow markers everywhere, and like she can just come pop up everywhere, like you never know, and you have to like really take that into consideration when you plan your moves. Luckily, now I also took Molly, so I actually almost removed all his shadow markers completely every turn.
Good job.
Yeah, so that really limited his access to go anywhere. So basically, he had like two turns when he popped up Misaki end of turn. So she basically had no moves left, and she had to pop up from a really bad positioning.
Nice. Yeah, I've yet to play against Misaki, but I think hiring Molly, even if you didn't declare her as your leader, is a strong move because she can be a hard counter there. So, Andreas, in general, what is your feelings on Von Stuck?
Von Stuck is my most played master. I think I have about 40 games with him in M3E.
Wow.
Yeah, I really played a lot coming up to this Nationals game. So I really was going to be in the top four. That was my goal all the time. So
so a question for Andreas. Have you listened to Jamie Varney's deep dive that we did on Von Stuck?
I have. I did.
And is there anything either that you felt he didn't talk about or some things that you've discovered but maybe we didn't cover there, some insights on Von Stuck that you have?
I think almost everything got mentioned that I've been figuring out with him, what I've been experimenting with. One of his side notes, like I really like to take...
Toshiro?
Toshiro, exactly. I really like to take Toshiro with Von Stuck because because I have both supports with the course markers made my setup, and it's just... I have the card draw to easier pull up some easy summons, and he protects really good his Ashigaris.
Yeah, and I would imagine too, if you can get him close to those undergraduates, can make them even hit harder.
Yeah, it's just for me, it's just a solid pick in most of my setups. I normally take Toshiro.
Very nice. I haven't tried that yet, Victor, Andreas, so I'm going to have to try that. It makes sense to me, though. And for those of you listening, you should be ready to hear a lot more about Von Stuck. He's, I think, one of the better masters in Rezzers, and the only thing that's kept him from getting some noise and hearing people talk about him is the fact that his box just came out. So, Victor, how about you? Can you kind of give us an idea of how day one went?
Yeah, so first match was me playing Sandeep versus Eric playing Gremlins Raida. My second match was Sandeep again versus Matthias Dreamer. And the last match was a Reckoning match that I didn't really want to play Sandeep in, so I chose Iron Sights instead. Played Kore, another person making the top four. He was playing Neverborn Sarita, and that game ended in a draw.
So did you, of the three matches, was there any one that you found particularly challenging?
Probably the last one. I haven't really prepared Ironsides a lot before. I think I only played like one match before the event with Ironsides. He brought a really tough Sarita list where everything was really hard kill. It was pretty hard to get some points. I think we ended like getting just 4 points each.
Yeah. Yeah. So by the time it hasn't come out while we're recording this, but by the time this gets released, we'll have released our deep dive on Ironsides. And I'm telling you, you only have to play against Ironsides once to realize that there's a lot of untapped power there. And in the right hands, Ironsides is a really, really good master.
Yeah, I agree. I can really feel the power there, but there's still a lot of learning for me there.
Now, the speaking of power, though, another master that I'm still surprised we don't hear more about is Sandeep, because I think Sandeep is good in third edition.
Yeah, I totally agree. I played Sandeep, as I said, the first two games and all of three games in day two. I think it's really, really good.
Yeah, he's not as dominating as he was in second edition pre-nerf. But I think, I'd be interested to know if you agree, Victor, his flexibility is still there, which I think can make him an easy kind of go-to.
Yeah, I really agree. He can do almost anything. As I said, the Reckoning is perhaps not the best thing for him because of his summons, but otherwise he can basically do anything you want. He's super flexible.
Very cool. Well, gentlemen, let's go ahead and take a break. When we get back from the break, I want to slow down just a little bit. We're going to go round by round and really kind of lean in to learn more about how day two went for each of these guys. So we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, so now we kind of see how these guys, you know, how Yukim and Victor qualified for day one to get to the winner's bracket. But the pools that we talk about here are actually played in both the side tournament and in the main event that second day. And like I said, Andreas, I think you ended up finishing second, right, out of your side tournament?
I actually won the side tournament.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah. Geez, I got all the winners on. I don't know why I had in my head you got second. So, wow. Okay. So let's talk about round one. So it was a flank turf war pool. You had Harness the Ley Lines, Vendetta, Breakthrough, Hold Up Their Forces, and Power Ritual. Pretty interesting pool. You've got really three schemes that kind of force the action either on the center line, in the backfield, or in the corners. And on flank, that Power Ritual is, you know, way out in the corners. But then you've also got Hold Up Their Forces and Vendetta, which really can happen just about anywhere, depending on how you pick it. So, Andreas, first off, what did you bring and what did you pick?
So, going for this, when my opponent announced Outcast, I was figuring I should maybe take von Stuck as he's my most played master. But as it was a flank turf war, I actually like Kirai. So I think that's a kind of good pool. I know this opponent from before. I know he played Leviticus in the second edition. So I think that I could make it work. But when we announced masters, he picked Jack Daw.
Oh, wow.
And I have some experience with Jackdaw as a racer. I never met him in Outcast, so I'm not really sure what versatile models he goes with or upgrades. I felt a little... it was not too good for me because Kirai's average VP is 5 around their keyword, and he have a lot of terrifying.
Yep.
So I picked in the end, I just figured that I would overwhelm him. So I picked my standard crew. That's Kirai, Ikiru, Datsuba, Lost Love, 2 Seishins, 2 Onryu, Goryu, and 1 Shikome. And of course, nice. Whisper Song Kirai. He picked a rather elite crew with Jackdaw. So he had Jackdaw, Montressor, Hanged with Servant of Darkness power, 2 Guilty, Midnight Stalker, and Lady Ligia. So I outnumbered him quite good. And because it was flank, I just figured that Hold Up the Force and Harness the Ley Line should be pretty good because I had it easy to just put out summon models that could score me, Hold Up the Forces, and just go to the side with the Ley Lines while he was more elite, a little more like clumped up. So I figured that I should just go to the sides and try to hold him in the middle.
Do you remember what schemes he picked?
I believe I can actually check that if you give me a second. He picked Vendetta and Breakthrough.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah, with an elite crew, he was pretty limited, so that makes sense.
Yeah. So, let's see. Everything went almost according to plan. So, because he had so much terrifying, his hand and Jackdaw himself, like, I just made the decision, like, I should just hold them up. So I sent my Ikaru missile into the middle of his crew and tie up four of them. Barely did any damage at all, but she had at least held them together. And he had this awkward situation to either disengage and try to walk around her and try to do something, or kill her and then expect a new Ikaru later in the turn unactivated. So he chose to not kill her, just leave her there, disengage out from her and try to do the best he can out from that. And because of this, because of how the positioning of the terrain was, he had to like squeeze himself to between two houses to like access to the middle, and then from there try to spread out on the sides to get to my turfs and get to my side of the board. But I just made a wall of summons with Kirai and just control the sides, the flanks of the board. So I easily scored 2 points with Leyline and both hold up the forces with my summons.
Very nice. Very nice. What was the final score?
The end score was 6-4 to me.
Very nice. How about you, Victor? What was your matchup into round one of day two?
So my first match was actually against Joachim. So I was going to play Sandeep and going into Shenlong. This was the match I probably dreaded the most, since I haven't really matched up against Shenlong and heard a lot of horror stories. But anyway, I chose to play Sandeep, as I said, with Banasuva, Kandara, and an Ice Golem. On the Ice Golem, I put Magical Training to hopefully mitigate some of the Shenlong's attacks in case he wanted to hit him. I also chose a Steam Arachnid Swarm with Magical Training, a Carlos Vasquez for like scheme running, and then the Medical Automaton also to hopefully help out against Shenlong in case he wanted to dive in on Sandeep himself.
Yeah, now, obviously you lost 8-0, right? Because you were playing against Shenlong?
Yeah, obviously. No, no, we actually managed to tie the game at 3-3.
Oh, wow, low scoring game.
Yeah. If you want, Joachim could perhaps talk about his list and then we'll talk about the how the game went.
That sounds great.
Yeah, so I can only agree with Victor that this game was super stressful. I went into it kind of expecting Sandeep, and just from reading about him, I think that he provides like a really powerful kind of summoning, summoning good models with very few limitations, and they are surprisingly tanky as well. So I thought that I had to make some sort of crew that could potentially either kill Sandeep himself or try to somehow keep up with killing off those summons so that I wouldn't be overwhelmed. I ended up going with Shenlong, two aspiring students, a samurai, the lone swordsman, a charm warder, thunder archer, tanuki, and a low river monk.
Interesting. So you flexed out to a lot of versatile models.
Yeah, I often do, actually. I think my personal opinion is that the monk keyword is pretty average at best. A lot of the models are super squishy and pretty unreliable, as long as you don't like have 12s and 13s on hand to keep throwing on them. And you usually don't want to do that on a minion's defense
foot. Yeah. So what was it that kind of led to the tie? Was there a moment in the game where, well, first of all, And usually when you have a tie game, there's one person that lost the tie and one person that won the tie, right? So there was somebody at some point that was behind and ahead, but they eked out a tie. Kind of going into the final turn, was somebody ahead or behind? Or were you guys just neck and neck the whole time?
I think we should actually like go back to the first turn, since that was a huge turning point, point in this game.
Yeah.
It was there were several like big back and forths that actually pretty much had me giving up on the game like two times between turn one and two. And then it like turned back into an even game. And the big turning point, the way I see it, was at the end of turn one. I saw the opportunity for Shenlong to go past a lot of Victor's crew and reach the Medibot at the back with a Falling Rave Kick to basically guarantee 5 damage with the hand I had. So I thought that I could end turn one by killing the Medibot. And I agonized over whether doing that would be the right thing to do or not, thought for a long time. And I ended up going all in on this really, in a way, desperate strategy that I think was actually pretty good in the end, but it was also extremely risky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was probably like the right decision, though that also ended up him up in the middle of my crew, but also next to Sandeep, which had me very scared.
Sure. So did the Metabot survive turn one?
No.
Yeah. So now the Metabot's down, Victor. You've got Shenlong right in the middle of your crew, way too close to Sandeep for your taste. What's the move there? What happens turn two?
So it wasn't actually the actual end of turn one. I had like one or two activations left and managed to get the Ice Golem into Shenlong.
Nice.
And with some pretty good flips, I managed to take Shenlong down to half health or slightly below half health, I think.
Yeah, a severe on a negative flip, I think.
Yeah, something like that. So that was pretty lucky. But it then came to like the initiative flip on turn two. I at least thought that would decide a lot of things.
So who won the initiative?
I managed to win the initiative and thought, well, the Ice Golem probably has the best chance of killing Shenlong. So the first attack should have taken, the first attack hit to take him down a couple of wounds to like 2 wounds, I think. The second attack hit again, did 3 damage. I think Joachim was a bit undecided whether he would stone that or not. But he decided to stone it, flipped a severe. So Shenlong was still above hard to kill. And then my golem couldn't kill him anymore. He still like punched his third attack and did the second or the next to the second point of damage. So he's down to 1. But he survived the first activation.
And Joachim, at that point, I assume that you activated Shenlong, right?
Yeah, I definitely did. Shenlong on 1 wound left. And what basically happened was that I managed to use all of my high cards to kill Sandeep. I did the Shenlong thing that most people are scared of. I stoned for a ram to guarantee the trigger to do irreducible damage. And I think I also used Chi to get up to stat 8. So it takes a lot of resources, but I figured that killing Sandeep was super important in this game.
Yeah.
And given the chance, I took it, and then Shenlong immediately died after. So we played basically the entire game without masters.
Oh, that's crazy. You know, at that point, Joachim, you're going into turn two saying that like this could be terrible. Like I could lose this badly. Taking out Sandeep is huge, though, because that's a big part. I mean, he's one of those masters that's a linchpin to the crew and to the strategy. Playing out over the next couple turns, was it just a matter of, was there a lot of conflict, or did you guys just kind of go do your thing and stay out of each other's way?
There was definitely a lot of conflict. There was basically 2 flanks to the game where I tried to position my Thunder Archer and like take out models to hamper Victor's ability to scheme properly. So it ended up being a really low scoring game.
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys tied, which we, you know, later find out you guys were going to tie for the overall event itself. So Joachim, for those that have never played against Sandeep or maybe are struggling against Sandeep, can you give any tips on kind of what they can do to potentially beat him or things to watch out for?
Sandeep is one of those masters that is so flexible that it's like difficult to point at any single weakness that you can exploit. But I would say that trying to go for Sandeep or at least pressure Sandeep is pretty important since he isn't all that tanky. Shield 2 is pretty good, but only 10 wounds, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So if you can put pressure on Sandeep, you should do it since he brings so much to the table, like lots and lots and lots of good models, and also that like semi obey thing that helps immensely with scheming. So if you can get rid of Sandeep himself, that's super important.
And Victor, same question to you, but reversed. So for those that are scared to death of Shenlong, anything you took away from that, or any advice you can give?
I mean, I'm probably still scared to death of Shenlong, but I don't know. It feels like you can't really leave Shenlong alive, much as you shouldn't leave like Sandeep alive. If he just gets to do his thing, then he'll delete models each turn and probably win the game by that. But honestly, I haven't really figured out a good way to handle Shenlong other than just trying your best to kill him.
Well, and I think it's okay that it's just as simple as that. I mean, you're talking about a master that's going to be in the thick of things. He's a problem. He can't stick around. So the simplicity of that doesn't invalidate it at all. In general, though, you know, Joachim brought a lot of versatile models. So as the next several turns played out, which of his models you think really was the critical pick for him? Who scored him the points and had the biggest impact on the table of all those versatiles he brought in?
The lone swordsman probably cleared up one of the flanks pretty good by himself, and also the charm warder did the really clutch one of his attack has the trigger to just kill a summon outright. So he managed to kill the one wind gammon that I summoned turn one, and that probably denied him at least 1 point. Because the twin gammon probably should have given me a point on like breakthrough or something like that.
Yeah, Lone Swordsman's a good model. I've only faced him in a Yan Lo crew, he became a target priority because you just read his card and you realize just how good he is. So you can obviously the Ice Golem was a big part of the crew that impacted the game. Was there any other models that that Victor brought that you felt really had a big impact?
I think there were multiple models that had a big impact on my overall strategy in a way. Two of the models that really stand out to me are Kandara with her ability to give the crew a lot of card draw. And that's one of the things that I'm worried about when I'm playing Shenlong. He is super efficient if he can like hit his attacks and have severes left over to do is 5 damage, since moderate of 3 isn't all that impressive. It's good, but not the kind of damage people are scared about. So Kandara bringing a lot of card draw was one thing that worried me, and also Carlos, of course, since he could pretty much do all of the schemes. There were 3 schemes in this pool that Carlos would do really efficiently by himself, so I had to focus on him.
So that takes care of round one and day two. We know that you guys played each other and tied, which means we have some wins coming up here. So let's take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about round two, which is a plant explosives round. So I'll be very interested to see how that plays out. We'll be right back.
Hi, guys and girls, ladies and gents. I'm Kevin Smith. I'm the Southwest boy living in the southeast of the UK. I contribute $18, or £13 a month, to Third Floor Wars. And why? Well, I work 50 hours a week as a supermarket manager, have three children, so in my spare time, I just want to play foe. And if I can't do that, the next best thing is listening to the Third Floor Wars podcast. Not only do I hear about what I play and the gaps in my knowledge, but I also hear about all of the crews and tactics that I need to beat, and often how they've even performed in recent tournament reports. The online store has some great merchandise, including t-shirts and mugs to buy now to show your support. You should be a Patreon too. So pause this episode and go to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, or grab the link in the show notes.
So how much are three or four of these episodes worth to you a month? Third Floor Wars has a Patreon, and if you think they're worth $1, $5, $20 a month, swing by and become a patron. We have polls to decide the next episode of the pod, along with early releases of articles and podcasts. Everything we release goes out to everyone, but sometimes our patrons get a head start. The link is in the show notes, or just search for Third Floor Wars on Patreon.com. Thanks for the support. Hey, want to take a quick minute to thank some of our newest patrons. We really appreciate your support. Thank you to Andre, LaShawn Allen, Gier Hagen, Dave Gross, Vlad Barrel, Gazgul, Robert Singer, Joseph Gerard, Matt Carter, Corin Soles, and Matthew Overton. We appreciate it. Okay, so now we go into round two. Round two was Wedge Plant Explosives. It's had assassinate, dig their graves, deliver a message, detonate the charges, and harness the ley lines. So Victor, with that pool, kind of what were your first thoughts when you saw the pool?
Well, as we said, Sandeep is super flexible. He can do most things. And I played him most of day one and the first game day two, so he felt the most comfortable.
Yeah.
So I decided to play him, and we ended up against Kore, my opponent from the third round in day one. Mm-hmm. Though this time he was going to play Dreamer instead. Luckily I played against Dreamer like two times at least before the tournament, which have given me at least some insights. And so I ended up with a crew of Sandeep and Benesu, of course, with Kandara, Carlos, Windgammon, and the Souls of Mine with medical training for some scheming, a Fire Gammon to then build into a Fire Golem. Mm-hmm. And then as a bit of a tech pick, I chose Elijah Porgman. Playing against Dreamer before, I've faced the issue that terrifying can be a problem, especially when I usually bring an Arachnid Swarm into that spot, which has just a VP4. But Elijah is quite a good beater and has Ruthless, so that's pretty nice. And Corey was then playing Dreamer with Lord Jumpybits, Wither Weaver, Hinamatsu, Serena Bowman, two Daydreams, and then Vasilisa together with two Wicked Dolls.
Ooh, that's a good crew.
Yes. Yes, it was really scary.
So how did it play out?
So we, at the end of turn one, I think, Hinamatsu just charged into the middle of my crew, managed to kill one of my Fire Gamins that should have been brought into a Golem. So it disrupted those plans a bit. And then it was basically, at least at the start of turn two, was trying to handle Hinamatsu and getting her killed. With on a flank, Chompy was trying to chase down Carlos from getting me a lot of victory points. And on the other flank, he was trying to have Vasilisa with some Wicked Dolls and the Widow Weaver to drop some bombs, basically. At the end, I guess I managed to just eke out some wins here and there and kill a bunch of things and deny some points in order to eke out a 5-3 win.
Oh, wow. Now, did you end up being able to put together a Golem, or did that just dash the plans and you never went back to it?
No, turn two, well, I got the Golem.
Gotcha.
It's usually pretty easy to at least get it together at some point. Though not getting it turn one is a bit of a problem, since then you're not really doing that much with it on turn two if it isn't built together in turn one.
So, Victor, in general, kind of what is your approach to Corrupted Idols? How do you play that strategy?
So this one was actually Plant Explosives, not Corrupted Idols.
Or Plant Explosives, I meant. Sorry.
Yeah. So with this crew, I basically try to have, like, Carlos can take two bombs. He's such an efficient scheme runner that he can just run out on the flank. And if he isn't properly chased down, he can score some points easily with that. But as for my general strategy, I guess just with Sandeep, I'm usually not getting that deep into the enemy territory, but more playing, planting my bombs pretty close to the center lines, at least the first couple of bombs, and then just trying to deny as much as I can.
Playing defense. Side.
Yeah.
Do you remember off the top of your head how many explosives he scored? Did he get 1, 2, 3 points off it? Do you remember?
Yes, give me a second. He got so I got 2 and he actually got 2.
Gotcha.
So didn't really manage to, or well, he managed to deny me a bit and I managed to deny him a bit. Chompy managed to chase down the Carlos pretty good. And I guess I killed Vasilisa or Weaver at some point.
God,
I don't really remember.
So, Andreas, tell me about your round two.
So, round two was a quite funny one because I got paired against all the permanent two from day one. So, 10 Thunders, Nisaki. And as this was also a plant explosives, I picked the same crew again, and he picked the same crew again. So we had a rematch. So that was interesting. So we had a Misaki against Molly, and my Molly list is, yes, my standard Molly list for explosives. So I have Molly, Necrotic Machine, Rogue Necromancy, Archie, Forgotten Marshal with Whisper, 2 Cruel Guns, and 2 Night Terrors. So,
nice.
And he had Misaki, Shang, Minako Ray, Yamazuko, Yasunori, mm-hmm. Torakage, Dawn Serpent, and then one Waku Raider.
That's a good crew.
Yeah, so he had a quite heavy crew. I have really much respect for Yasunori. Joachim have damaged me from second edition.
Mm-hmm.
And it still does pretty well in this edition too. Like, he's not as good, but he's still pretty damn good. So again, plant explosives. So because my crew is so light and have so many models, it was easy for me to just put out my bombs on my cruel guns and night terrors and easy just to run up and deploy them almost immediately. He, because he had a more tough crew, I felt like he had some problem putting out his bombs. He ended up putting 2 on Misaki, and it's quite easy for her to, well, put out the bombs, but it's not really what he wanted to do with her in the end. So, and it showed on the turns we played.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really get time to do it in real. So, and one more thing that's quite interesting, because in my deployment zone, I had a big box 2-inch. So I just put Molly on that box and just stood there almost the whole game, because we didn't have so tall terrain. So she basically saw his whole crew all the time. So
mm-hmm.
with the leaf caress, he had to do some annoying things to avoid that damage from her, from Molly.
Yeah, that Les Caress can be a nice speed bump for Yasunori.
Yeah, so the thing with Yasunori, in the turn two, he decided he had to do something because he had so many expensive models and he ended up like just circling around, not like really engaging. Meanwhile, I was just pushing up and dropping my bombs and he didn't get anything done. So to do something, he just decided to, it was time for Yasunori to do something. So he went up and charged a cruel gun almost next to Molly, killed it quite easy. And then he realized that his only defense that he reduce damage depending on suit and how many cards the opponent had on his hand doesn't work against Molly's Lefkaris.
Yep.
So he basically almost killed himself, and when he realized it, he just said it was too late to do anything, so he just went through with it. So he had activated like 4 life Yasinori just next to my Molly early turn 2. So I just took my town, stole the turn out, and when he didn't have any hand left because I was quite aggressive against him, I just did attack him twice with unreducible damage and killed his Yasinori.
So the one thing I think that's interesting there, Andreas, is, you know, there's all kinds of different ways to approach plant explosives. And what your opponent did is not uncommon, which is, you know, load up the master or load up a henchman. But it's interesting, you spread out your bombs to just the little guys, to the minions. Is that something you always do? Or is that something you did specifically because of this matchup?
I do it because, like, the Krulligans are so good with it, because I have 2 keep anchors to jump to, and both have the Rogue Necromancy and Arch to jump to. So I basically just walk up with Rogue Necromancy and the Archie on different flanks, and then I just jump up to them and successfully drop the bombs turn 1.
Yep.
And that opens up the possibility to deny my opponent more bombs the next turns and his strategies and schemes.
So, Andreas, I've had people on the show that are big fans of the Night Terrors, and I've had people on the show that think they're garbage. You took 2 of them, so obviously you don't think they're garbage. Where do you find value in the Night Terrors?
What I really like about them is the Concealment Aura. Really helps a lot, and it's enough, you know, like it's many opponents too that like forgets about it, never takes it in consideration, and then when they just realize like, okay, I'm gonna toss obey on you or something, no, minus flip.
Do you use them as bodyguards, or are you keeping them near the Rogue Necromancy and Archie, or are you letting them kind of do their own thing?
I normally at least at the first turns so the thing is with Molly Screw, it's quite hard to like position them perfect. It needs a lot of practice, because when you drop the discard a card for Night Terrors, forgotten ability, they will push and they will damage when they push too. So you need to like make sure you have everything perfect set up. So normally the first turns I have them following some bigger model, but then later on like just breaks out and scheme and in this case should plant bones for me.
Yeah, no question. So what was the final score?
The final score was a win with 5-4. So it was very hard. It was hard. So also, one more key point about this game I want to mention. Both day 1 and day 2, he picked Minako Ray. And Minako Ray have this real annoying thing. If you damage it, it puts upgrade on you. Summons things if you die and just damage you if you keep damaging it. But both day 1 and day 2, I just had Forgotten the Marshal run up to me and put him in a box.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
He got stuck there both games for 2 turns. He basically did not do anything. Meanwhile, Forgotten Marshall's bonus action is a summon. So I just ran up once, charged him, boxed him, and then summoned. And I did that twice. So he really denied it.
Very, very nice. Well, that's a good win, man. That's a good win. Yukim, how about you? How did your round 2 go?
So my round 2, interestingly, was also basically a rematch of the first day. It wasn't the exact same scenario, but I think it was, I played Alexander with Lucius in another strategy first, but now it was plant explosives instead. But the scheme pool was fairly similar, and we ended up picking basically the exact same crews again. So... again, a rematch in a way, but this one went pretty differently. I got a really strong start. I managed to block him really well, since he had a doppelganger go up on one flank, and I managed to like measure out the terrain and the distance to the edge of the table and see that if I put Yasunori here, he can't go past. So there was like this passage right beside a big building that was just the right distance from the table edge so that it was basically impossible to get past Yasunori. So I managed to like win that flank pretty easily. On the other flank, he had the agent 46 or 47. Well, I can't remember exactly. And the agent turned out to be surprisingly annoying for Shenlong, since not being able to cheat against him was really, really tough. He did quite a lot of damage, but I managed to overpower that flank after a while as well. And from that point, I just played super aggressively and tried to kill a lot of Lucius models, since Lucius' crew overall doesn't feel very tanky.
Yeah.
And in the end, I could win with 7-2.
Oh, wow.
Mostly because of, like, his model didn't get past the center line with the level of threat I had from Shenlong, Yasunori, a samurai, and a bunch of smaller models that could also threaten his smaller models.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that there was something that he could have done better, or things that would have, do you think, have had a bigger impact on the game?
This particular game, I think it's a difficult one. He could have probably scored more VP if he had picked other schemes. I felt like this game was pretty much in my favor from crew selection. I thought that the first time we played, I would have a big advantage as well. But in that game, I ended up getting like this very strangely, eerily bad hands, while in this game, I instead got extremely good hands. So that made a huge difference.
Makes the game easier.
Yeah, it does. I typically don't like to put too much weight in my analysis of a game on. I don't want too much of it to be about the hands, but I definitely think that both of these games, the cards we drew, had a big impact.
Yeah, and the reality is, I'm the same way, Yukim. I don't like to blame the cards, right? Whether it be, you know, he won because he had great hands, but the reality is that you can have huge swings if you have both situations happening where one player is consistently lucky in their draws and the other player is having a tough time, and that's just the reality of it. Luckily, structurally, that's pretty rare. You know, usually it evens out because it's got a, you know, it's a random number generator, but with a fixed pool of numbers because of the way the cards work. But, you know, in the same way I say stop blaming the cards, because you don't learn anything if you blame the cards, you know, we're also not idiots in saying that, you know, the cards are a factor. But they're not going to cause the swinginess that dice will.
Yeah, exactly. And especially in a game like this, where he had a crew that was not especially tanky, all it takes is basically like one statistically odd round is enough for him to lose like half of his crew.
Yeah.
So
you punish him for having that bad hand.
Yeah, basically. It's really difficult to play from that sort of position where you have a bad hand. That's something that I've been like struggling with and trying to improve for years by now in Malifaux, how to play with a bad hand.
So a lot of times switching gears and handling that can be tough. And the other thing that's tough, man, is, you know, I think Lucius is better than people give him credit for, but nothing will crush a Lucius turn like a bad hand, because Lucius has so many target numbers to do what he's trying to do. And if you don't have the hand to push through those key ones and are just relying on top decking some of those target numbers, that can make up for a really bad turn with Lucius. And unlike, to your point, unlike other crews, they can't just sit back and survive the turn to get through that bad hand, because it's not hard to bring down some of those models. So too bad for him. Good for you. But too bad for him. That sucks. Well, that kind of covers round two. Let's take a quick break. And we get back from this break, I want to talk about the final round. But before we do that, right now you're on one win, one tie. And yeah. What's your differential?
I think it's like +5 by this point.
And how about you, Victor?
I'm at +2 instead.
Okay, so right now, so again, we know what ends up happening here, but it's the pressure's on Victor to not only win, but you're going to have to get some VP, get some differential in place in order for you to even think about coming out ahead at that point. So let's find out how that played out. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. With third edition Malifaux released, it's time for you to get a new mat with new deployment zones. We've tried every mat in the business and nobody has better quality and selection than Mats by Mars. They're waterproof and they roll and unroll easily, and they're even wet erase Marco compatible. They offer over 35 designs and let you add M3E overlays for making deployment and positioning a breeze. Check them out at matsbymars.com. They are offering a sweet discount for our listeners. After you found the perfect mat, use the promo code THIRDFLOOR to get 10% off your entire order. If you really want to support us, in the notes of your order, request that our logo be put in the corner of your mat. It's the only way to make the best mat in the business even cooler. Again, that's Mat by Mars. Use the promo code THIRDFLOOR to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. All right, so round three. We know Andreas is going to have a good round because he ended up winning this. We know Victor is going to have a good round because he ended up being able to catch up to Yukim. And obviously, Yukim, you're going to have a win as well because we know you had two of them. So I'm going to finish with Victor. So Yukim, I'm going to go right to you. Let's talk about your third round.
So my third round was against Kåre, who Victor also played earlier. And against me, Kåre picked Dreamer. I was really, really hoping that he would go for Zoraida, since one of my close friends who I've played against a lot also plays Zoraida, and I've been able to like come up with some really strong counter tech in Ten Thunders. Yep. But he ended up going with Dreamer instead, which was the option I feared the most, since I feel like it's really, really difficult to keep up with the Dreamer player with the amount of powerful summoning that he has. Yep. So also me and Kåre, we've had a bunch of really, really, really close games earlier as well. He is from the south of Sweden, the meta that they have down there. And when I have traveled for tournaments, I typically end up going up against him, and we always have really, really tough games. So mm-hmm. I was pretty scared going into this.
And I forgot to mention the pool. Let me do the pool real quick. So we had standard corrupt idols with claim jump, take prisoner, power ritual, search the ruins, and outflank. So I'm going to go back to a question I asked earlier, but when I got the pool, the strat wrong. What, you know, going into corrupted idols on standard, what is the approach?
So when it comes to corrupted idols, regardless of what kind of crew I'm playing, I definitely want to try to save resources, save cards to be able to impact initiative. I feel like a huge part of an idols game is about making sure that the idols preferably end up being where you can take them, and yep. if not somewhere far out of the way where the opponent can't take them. So I try to prioritize that really. That was my top priority basically in this game.
And do you in your crew, do you don't have a whole lot of card draw in your crew, do you?
No, I suppose I can get some card draw since I could take Sensei Yu, but I feel like he's a bit too expensive for what he does. And I also know about the trick. I've been considering doing the thing with Kitty Dumont, bringing in an out of keyword model to basically just hit Yasunori and draw 6 cards per turn.
Yep.
A really, really cheesy combination. But I haven't really gotten around to actually making some sort of proxy or conversion of her. So I don't really have that sort of easy, efficient card rule to use.
So that leaves you then to, you know, get what you can in your hand, and you're keeping, you know, keeping a severe, I would assume, in your hand from round to round to really kind of hopefully help you control those idle drops.
Yeah, basically. And what's interesting in this kind of game is, since he played Dreamer, and one of the big parts about Dreamer is that you really need to save a high card for his summoning to be efficient. So I think most turns he saved his high card for summoning, and I used my equally high card for winning initiative most turns. And that had a big impact on the kind of scoring we had. He fell behind on the strategy quite early. So I had a lead that I had to try to protect while most of my crew was dying around me, but I at least got the VP.
What did the score end up being?
The score ended up being 5-3, I believe. And if I'm wrong, I believe Andreas can correct me.
So you gained an additional 2 victory points there. So that dug even a deeper hole for Victor. So that's interesting. Any tips for people facing against Dreamer? Things that you think that they should keep in mind in order to potentially beat a Dreamer player?
This is also a really difficult kind of problem to solve. I do think that you should expect Stitched to come up. So if you have some sort of tech that is good against Stitched, it's an important thing to bring it. Attacks against willpower is good. Being able to ignore armor is also pretty good. And especially with the kind of crew Koora used, with Hinamatsu, Vasilisa, and Widowweaver. He had like lots of models where armor was a big problem. So me having a samurai was a good thing for me.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Andreas, how was your third round?
Yeah, so my third round, I got paired against my good friend Matthias. He is my training buddy, and he's the one I had my training against all summer. So we know each other pretty well, and he plays Neverborn. He knows I like Von Stuck, and I know he also likes Dreamer. But just to spice it up, the last game this day, I actually picked Kurai and surprised him a lot. Like you said, it's a standard Corrupted Idols. So I just picked my Kurai crew with Ikiru, Datsuba, Lost Love, 2 Sessions, 4 Onryo, Guri, and Shikome, because I just wanted to spread wide, control the idols, and just control the board. I know he also likes to go elite heavy with his Dreamer, because he just makes up the dead with his summons, and he really likes his Stitch together because they are broken. Okay, so he what he end pick up this time was really much of the same like a normal duo. He picked Dreamer, Chompy, Widowweaver, Carver, Teddy, Serena, and Insidious Madness.
Oh, wow, that is an elite crew.
It's super elite crew. I was actually surprised that he went this elite. I always expecting that he would actually hire 1 or 2 Stitched. He normally goes 3 Stitch in the beginning because they are just that good. And you can't do anything about it, and then they bypass everything. So, but he actually went with 0 when he was determined to just summon them instead. I take prisoner on Teddy, and I picked Outflank because with his elite crew, I could just easily take the sides while he was busy in the middle. So what, again, I did what Kirai is good with. I sent up Ikiru with a couple of stations, and he immediately was locked down with her in his deployment turn 1, and he had to like figure out how to deal with that. managed to walk around and kill the Kuro first time, and just went straight to the middle. And because he claimed them, which I didn't know at that point, I could have figured it out just looking at his crew. He has pushed out, but he didn't come that far because he just met my wall of continuous summoning, and he just couldn't do that much that game at anything, to be honest.
So, Andreas, I hear talk about Carver all the time in Dreamer. And some people, it's one of those models that some people love him, some people hate him. Did Carver have an impact on the game?
Carver did do that much this game. I have faced him before, and every time I faced him, like, he have a okay stat line and he have a building crit, but with a in the end, all they did was just fire breathing. He has fire breath and blasted all my models, which was good, but that was all he did. And it was, I just felt like it was not enough for the point value of it. Like, I was not impressed by it.
He's expensive.
Yeah. I'm very impressed by is again the Stitch Togethers and the Insidious Madness. So the Insidious Madness is a really good take in Corrupted Idol, because they have this really annoying push without defense. So you can't do anything. He just goes in there and push all your models away, and you can't flip or defense. It just happens.
Yep.
And you can't block any idols against it. So it's real annoying. And they're real hard to kill also for that soulstone point. They have terrifying, they are incorporeal and really fast. And it was just hard to deal with. One key point of the game was in turn three, I charged in the Ikiru on his chompy bits and Red Joker the damage and killed him straight out.
Nice.
Unactivated too. So my opponent, my good friend Matthias, he just took a deep sight at that time and just looked at me with tired eyes.
What was the final score?
The final score was 6-2 to me. So he really tried to take the search ruins, but I denied everything. And he managed to take the claim jump on his teddy because the end scoring. He didn't take the first score, but because he was in the middle for the end, he got the point for that.
Well, and that worked out. I mean, that worked out in his favor too, because you had picked him as your take prisoner target. So you were not about to get him off the table either.
Exactly. So that was the point too. Like, I only scored the take prisoner point because of the end scoring as well, because I held his crew together so much, so his teddy was never alone, so I couldn't get the take prisoners until the end of the game.
You kind of both gave each other the point at the end there, with him having claim jump and you having take prisoner.
Yeah.
That's funny, and on the same model. Victor, you have quite a hole to dig yourself out of here. We know that you ended up at plus 15. Joachim has put the pressure on with coming out with a higher VP and differential. So who did you face?
Yeah, so I, of course, then faced Alexander. I kept playing Sandeep. Felt pretty secure with that. And Alexander chose to play Euripides for this match.
Nice.
Yes. I played him once before, so I at least had a rough idea about what he did. I chose basically the same list as the game before. Sandeep, Banasuva, Kandara, Carlos, Fire Gamin, the Wind Gamin. It's also minor magical training, but instead of Elijah Borgman, I instead chose the Steam Arachnid Swarm with magical training instead of the perhaps usual diesel engine, because I thought at least the Euripides crew had a lot of triggers, so the counterspell would come in nice. Was my idea at least. And Alexander was playing, as I said, Euripides with the Primordial Magic, of course. He had Thune, two giants, a Cyclops, Icky and Serena Bowman, and then Eldritch Magic on either Thune or a giant. I don't really remember which one, to get the Dispel Magic. So I basically managed to, I guess, eke out, or, well, kill his mauls a bit quicker than he was managing to kill mine. He managed to get some ice pillars in the way in the beginning. I deployed pretty centrally, and he blocked off a bit with the ice pillars. And during the game, Thune managed to put some stuff into ice pillars. He has a trigger that basically turns a model into an ice pillar. But if you then...
Thune is so good.
Yeah. But if you then break that ice pillar, the model just pops back out. So I always managed to have another model nearby that you could pretty easily pop out the frozen model again. So yeah, he managed to put stuff in, but I pretty efficiently got it back out again. So it didn't impact that much, at least.
So what was the final score?
The final score was 7-2. So I managed to climb back out.
Nice.
And had the... So at the end, both my match against Alexander and Joachim's match against Alexander was 7-2. And then both our matches against Chorus was 5-3. So we really played exactly the same scores.
You really did. You guys honestly came to the tie because you played each other to a tie as well. Yeah. So I've talked to a couple of Neverborn players, and I've played against Euripides twice. Mm-hmm. And I'll keep my thoughts to myself real quick, but I hear a lot of Neverborn players that are concerned that Euripides, they feel, is behind the curve. Do you think that's true after playing against Euripides, or do you think he's strong, he's weak, or what's your take?
I'd probably agree that he's a bit behind the curve. There are some nice things there. He's the main mechanic, the old ways, managing to like pick up the top card of the discard pile. That's pretty good, at least if you haven't faced him that much, because at least I, several times during the games, like you just forget that, and then you attack something and oh, there's a 13 at the top of the discard pile, and yep, you just missed that attack then. But yeah, it feels like there's something missing in the crew. The crew is a bit squishy. Most of them just have hard kill, like as a defensive measure. And then, like, if you have some efficient beaters, then you just chew through that. So something is missing there, perhaps. But yeah, it's definitely playable.
Oh, it's definitely playable, and I think I follow where you do, which is maybe a little bit more durability would make a big difference, because you know that what's as good as that top deck, you know, using the top deck of the discard is the Euripides player has to be really careful not to kill himself or set himself up to be killed rather easily. It's one of those abilities that you read and you go, boy, that's so good. And then there are times that it's, you know, it's game changing that they can do that, especially when they do it with a red Joker or a severe. But by around turn three, if they were not careful, they end up with a lot of really easy targets to start taking off the board. So I think the crew does tend to struggle late game.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine how many laughs you guys must have had with that exact perfect tie in literally in every way. Guys, what I want to do is I want to learn a lot more about really what your thoughts are about the crews that you played. I want to talk a little bit about Malifaux third edition in general, and kind of what does M3E look like in Sweden? So let's take one more break. We'll be right back. Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. All right, so one of the things that was a goal of mine in putting this podcast together is to try to get as much international voices on here. Malifaux's played all over the world, and I just don't feel like previously other podcasts have done a great job of covering it. Basically, all through second edition, the only thing we ever heard from was the UK, the US, and Australia. So whenever I get an opportunity to get people from a different part of the world that doesn't normally have a voice, I want to talk to them really in general about the game. But unfortunately, the first thing we need to talk about is we need to talk about Shenlong, because that's what everybody else right. is talking about. So Yukim, I don't want to, spend too much time on it, but as a Shenlong player, you know what you're afraid of. That it's much harder to play him than I think the opponents realize. So I'd like to get a sense from you, in games that you've lost with him, or in games that, things went south, what are things that people need to keep in mind before they start talking about him being the greatest thing since sliced bread?
Yeah. So, well, basically, there are like a combination of smaller things that you could exploit if you end up facing Shenlong. He is scary. And I think that big kind of fear factor is one of the things that stop people from playing against him in an efficient manner. So one of the big things about him is that he is really potent and efficient. He can kill just about any kind of model, which is definitely scary. But it does take quite a lot of cards to do so. He is stat 6, and he can go up to stat 8 if you do the whole thing with stacking a lot of chi. So he will probably hit, but he might need to cheat for that. And when it comes to damaging, he flips negative flips to positive flips, so he has a decent chance of actually doing good damage. But most of the time, you want to have some sort of severe card to be able to sheet that 5 damage instead of just 2 or 3.
Yep.
Especially if you have a stone for a ram to make the damage irreducible. So you can basically expect against the Shenlong player that they shouldn't have many more cards. They shouldn't have high cards left after Shenlong has acted. So you can take that time to try to basically drown him in attacks, or mm-hmm. go after the rest of his crew if they are, well, either if they're tactically important to remove, or preferably if some of the squishy models have overextended, since that's quite easy to do.
Yeah, it's so easy when you lose to Shenlong the first couple times, just to remember your side of the board. And I think that your points are good ones, which is he's going to spend a lot of resources. Like, so for example, how many stones do you bring?
Yeah, that's one of the maybe strange things about my way of playing him. I have, since basically the beta, been playing mostly 10 soul stones.
Wow.
Definitely with Shenlong, I always bring 10 soul stones, and I feel like I bring too little if I have to bring 8, because I need to switch out some sort of model. And I do play with a big cache regardless of which master I play, basically.
Yeah, and you think about it, though. I mean, those 10 stones are going to bring a lot for you, right? Because you're going to be able to stone for the irreducible trigger if you need it. You're going to be able to, keep them standing by, reducing damage. To your point, as you said, he's card hungry in order for him to do what he needs to do. That big of a cache I could see as being very useful, but that means you've only got 40 stones worth of models on the table, which is, again, those opportunities. I think one of the things that Peter on the deep dive mentioned is, start nicking away at his crew, because it's going to typically be his crew that scores the points while Shenlong is causing problems. So I think that that's very helpful for doing that. Is there other 10 Thunders Masters that you've been getting a lot of play with, or has Shenlong been dominating your games?
I actually haven't really been playing Shenlong all that much. I focused on Misaki since back in the beta, and I tried to get a lot of games in and give feedback and make sure that she would keep on being fun, since I absolutely love her new mechanic. Yeah. She was the first master I picked up back in second edition. I wanted to pick up Shenlong back in second edition, but his crew box wasn't out yet, so I got Misaki and basically fell in love with her kind of playstyle, and it has only gotten much, much more fun in M3E.
That's great. Have you played with Asami or any of the other ones yet?
Yeah, I have. I have tried Asami for a bit, and I do think that she will be at least one of my projects coming up. I'm excited about trying quite a few different things with her, and I think she is definitely competitive. She might even be more competitive than Shenlong when it comes to her entire list.
Right.
And I do expect that Shenlong should get some sort of nerf, which I honestly think he should be getting.
So let's pretend that you were part of that process. Where do you think they could touch him up a little bit without turning him into garbage?
Oh, such a difficult question. But basically, I think it is the combination of him being able to use Drunken Kung Fu to flip negatives to positives on his regular attack that also has really good triggers.
Yep.
I would lean towards at least trying some sort of change where he either has to spend chi every time he wants to flip from a negative to a positive with Drunken Kung Fu, so that his resource generation is a bit more strained. Or if you want to try a slightly harsher change, I would make it so that only Falling Rave Kick, the action he gets from his Fermented River style upgrade, benefits from Drunken Kung Fu.
Ah, I gotcha. For some harder decision points for the Shenlong player.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that would make it would give incentive to more often use the other styles, which I feel definitely was the intention.
Yep. Yeah, I'll tell you the other thing too that I don't hear talk about enough, and I'd like to know what your thoughts are on this, is that I think part of what makes Shenlong so good is the incredibly powerful stable of versatile models that Ten Thunders has. And I wonder if the Shenlong problem might be a versatile model problem, not a Shenlong problem. Do you think that his ability to really bring in such good versatile models is also a factor in what people recognize?
I definitely think so. As you said, Ten Thunders have a lot of really good versatile models, and now that everyone has heard about how the Shenlong player who won UK Nationals have been playing, basically, most of what made his list so powerful is not Shenlong in himself, right. I think, but rather the combination of really strong versatile models and the way that he used them. So
yep.
I think this is like another example of where you could use those exact models in just about any Ten Thunders crew, in a crew led by any master, and it would be super strong.
No, I agree. In fact, for me, a big part of balance, because I'm a firm believer that one of the main things that makes Malifaux is that, you build to the pool, you build to the opponent. And I think the keyword system did a great job of making Malifaux feel more like Malifaux. And my concern about the Ten Thunders is not about Shenlong. It's about how good all of those versatile models are. And I don't pretend to have an answer for it, but we're seeing a little bit of that, the same crew coming with different masters in Ten Thunders, and less, except for Asami, less and less keyword models being brought in. And for me, that's that's making it less Malifaux. So I'd be very interested to see, you know, if Weird does anything with that. And it's, I'm not sitting here telling you that I think, you know, 10 Thunders are overpowered as a faction or they're the strongest faction there is. I'm not saying that at all. What bothers me is that I'm seeing less variety in the 10 Thunders crews, which is, I think, it creates a balance issue within the faction itself.
I actually pretty much agree with you. That might be dumb to do so, seeing as I am a 10 Thunders master, 10 Thunders player, rather. But
wouldn't you rather see the monks be better so that you were bringing more monks into your monk crew?
Yeah, I would. One of the big parts I really love about third edition is bringing back like the incentive to play thematic lists,
yep,
much more so than you did in second edition. It's one of the main selling points of the game, I think. So I want to see thematic lists being viable most of the time.
Me too. Me too. So Victor, you play my favorite faction of all time. I'm kind of, my first question, or what I want to find out from you is, you know, Sandeep was your guy, and you really, there's two reasons why you would play the same master, or three reasons I would say to play the same master. One, it's the one you're the most familiar with, and in a competitive environment, the more familiar you are with your crew, the better off you're going to do. Two, it's the only one you have. Is another reason why you might do it. And then third, it's because he's the best choice, even though you had you know, six different opponents and six different pools. Which of those were true for you?
I guess it would actually be a slight combination of all of them. He is one of the more the masters I've played the most during M3E, at least in the last part. I've played a bit of Karis recently as well, but at least for this tournament, I felt like the most comfortable playing Sandeep. As to only having a master available, I definitely have other masters available, though I do think that there's some scenarios where Sandeep isn't like the optimal pick.
Right.
As I mentioned earlier, Reckoning isn't really something I think he's the best in. And at least I've been looking at Colette being really good for at least plant explosives and she more schemy and fast pulls, though I don't have all of the things I want for Colette. I didn't have the Corvus, at least currently. So that wasn't really an option for this tournament.
Is there an Arcanist keyword or master that you think needs a little bit of help that you wish was better so that you would could focus on it more?
I think that most of them are in a pretty good spot. I haven't tried out Mayfeng or Hoffman. I only tried Colette a little bit, so I can't really talk about Hoffman or Mayfeng, though I think those look fine, at least. At least Hoffman has been looking really good. Perhaps Marcus is a master that I really like Marcus, or like he was the first master that I got in M2E, and I really wanted him to work, and did play him a bunch in the beta. But I don't know, after the beta I didn't really click with him. I'm not sure if he's too bad or whatever to like play in if you really want to win in the tournament, or if it's just that, I don't know, he is not really playing the way I would like him to play.
I think he does need a little bit of help. I like his mechanics. Yeah. The one thought I had about Marcus is his three new models, the Order Initiates. They're gorgeous models. I love those sculpts, but you never see a Marcus player bring. Usually they bring none of them. I might bring one of them. So I wonder if beefing up that model a little bit could help get Marcus on the table, because I think from a playstyle standpoint, he's pretty unique within the faction, but just not quite strong enough. So I agree with you.
Yeah. Mostly I think like the higher end is at least okay. The Blessed December is good, and the Cerberus is good. Yep. Miranda is pretty good. Koju might be like at least passable, at least with, I think the Toss has some interesting capabilities, and he's like, yep, like okay at many things. But like the lower end is probably where he struggles. I don't really like the Mole Man. I don't really like the Horcas either. So like the lower end is struggling, and perhaps that's something where the Aura Initiates could be, if they like were reducing cost and perhaps altered a bit, they could fill that slot instead. Because at 7, why wouldn't you just pay a point more and get a Cerberus?
Exactly.
It's often what I feel.
Exactly. And really, I mean, I think the thing for the Order Initiates is it, if you push them down to help shore up that lower end of the Soulstone hiring, that could be enough to make the difference. So, Victor, you played through beta, right?
Yeah.
So coming out of beta and now, you know, several months of playing M3E, do you think the game is in a better place than it was in 2?
Yeah, I at least really like a lot of the changes that have been done. As you've previously mentioned, the keyword system that really tries to diversify the lists is something that I really, really love. Getting more variety on the table is a really good thing for M3 or for Malifaux in general.
Yeah.
And I mean, it does feel like a better game probably than second edition.
So popularity wise, where are things in Sweden now versus where they were at the height of 2? Do you guys have about the same player base around, or is it grown or is it shrank?
During the beta, as probably most of the, from like most of the places, it did die down quite a bit. We were a core group of people that did play at least a bit during the beta, but most of the people who had Malifaux as perhaps their second game, many people here play Age of Sigmar or Warhammer 40K or like War Machine or other games, and perhaps has Malifaux as their second game or. Then they like fell off mostly during the beta. Some of them have come back, but I think we still have plenty more players to bring in if we work a bit on it.
Yeah. So Andreas, I got a question for you. Let's pretend you could wave a magic wand and make one wish. What do you think could happen to really take the amount of people that play Malifaux to the next level? What do you think could happen to really grow the game?
What can really grow it is I would really like to see more people take up and like make more videos about it and like really like advertise more about it and see and show everyone what great game this is. You are, if I may say it, the best out there right now for
thank
for,
you.
if you want to know Malifaux, it's the first or worst that everyone should take a look at. Just see if we can just make it out, keep it a voice up, and see if we can bring in more people. From my experience and from what I've seen, also that I think more people would love this game if they just took the chance and try it. But there's so many people that are so comfortable with what they're doing. If they play 40K, they want to play 40K. They love 40K. I have no problem. That's really good for them. But they don't want to even try anything other.
Yep.
It's sad when there's probably they would really love it, but they wouldn't even take the time to try it.
Yeah, I've yet to show Malifaux to somebody and play a demo game with them and then not come out of it saying, yeah, this is something I want to do again. So I think your point's a good one. I think something that can be very helpful, and it's something we try to do here in North Carolina in the US, is we try to stop playing in each other's houses and play at the game stores. And I think that increases the profile of the game and helps it get up there. I think hopefully soon we'll start seeing the availability of models increase. I think that would help kind of get it out there. But your initial point is a good one, which is, you know, we've only got a handful of podcasts right now covering Malifaux and even fewer channels on YouTube. So for those of you listening, there's only one way to do that, and that's for you to grab a mic and start recording. And if you need any advice or anything, people can reach me on Facebook. Kyle is over at Schemes and Stones is also very generous, and same with Doug on The Scoundrels. We definitely could to hear some more. People are tired of hearing me, so I'm definitely with you. So Andreas, I do want to talk about our faction, the Rezzers faction. Do you kind of, if you were forced to kind of tier the keywords, what do you think is kind of the top tier in our faction, and who do you think is struggling?
So the top tier will be Albus, it will be Molly, and I would say Karai.
Yeah.
Janlo is up there. I haven't played him that much yet, and I know there's like much people liking him. I liked him too, but I just need more games with him. But I know he's just up there. People that needs help are one that I actually haven't yet to play yet, but just by looking at her, she didn't look as exciting, and I never seen anything writing thing about her. It's Riva.
Yeah.
She just looks like she underperformed. She's just not that interesting anything. She took away the one thing that made her really, really exciting in the second, and just cut it in half and added some pyro markers. It just...
Yeah. The thing about Reva is that, you know, you read her card and you read her crew and she reads confusing. She just, you're not quite sure what's the idea here. She just seems confused. And it's even worse when you try to play her, believe it or not. Yeah. Like sometimes you'll read something and then you beat it on the table. You're like, oh, okay, now this kind of makes sense. I've put her on the table 3 or 4 times now, and she gets worse in my mind the more I play her. And it's because there's not only is there a scatter of what she's trying to do, it's unfocused, but they actually fight each other. And it just makes it tough. And don't get me wrong, in every faction, there's going to be the masters that are quote unquote better and those that are weaker. I just feel like from a design perspective, Reva needs to find a place in Rezzers, and she doesn't have one right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I hope to see if she can get tweaked a bit, because I love her model. I love her crew. Like,
me too.
It looks good. They were really fun in M2E.
Yep.
But I want to see her come back again and see if they can make something with her. One small thing also, like so many other have pointed out too as well, it's just Seamus' crew. Not Seamus himself, but his crew, or his keyword in general. It's too hard to make it work efficiently. When you get it to work and you get that minus VP out, minus flip for VP duels, it's really great, but it's you're not supposed to clump up in M3, and if you group up like that, you will most likely be punished for it.
Yeah, you know what I feel like with Red Chapel, Andreas, is I feel like we're one model away from that keyword clicking. And I don't know what that one model is going to be, but I think that if they could bring out one or maybe two more Red Chapel models, or maybe tweak Bat or tweak Savelle a little bit, and it would become a different type of thing. But I definitely get the point you're making.
In the beta, he had this interesting keyword before they changed it. So all his models' keyword were able to basically pass their turn. Like they could activate, but they just choose not to. Then they would get get an effect, and then it would be the opponent's turn. So basically, it's a pseudo pass token. So you can always make sure to be the last player. There was a lot of complaints about this because it contradicted the whole idea with the pass token in general. So it made him more unique that way. But when the new devs took over, they removed it and changed to this one.
Yeah, yeah, and it I mean, we had, I think that Stephen did a great deep dive on Sheamus and really showed where some of that power is. And that play style of that he talked about, not the peekaboo Sheamus, but more of a, you know, pushing stuff around and pushing stuff into Sheamus. I think with, you know, one or two more models that kind of fit that play style, and suddenly I think you have something that could be truly unique. Andreas, we're going to, I want to talk about some plugs, and you're the first one I'm going to go to because you are a content creator, and I think that you have been putting out some good stuff. So let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing.
Yeah, so what I've been doing is, like, I figured out I wanted to show off Malifaux, so I started to make battle reports on my YouTube channel. I have three of them, and then it kind of died off my channel. It's not that I never lost interest in it. It's just that I even recorded two more battle reports, but they were flawed in different ways, and I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I want only to put out the best. And then it was some other things. I became a dad again, and it's just real life just consumed me, so I didn't have any more time for my hobby. I am about to awake my channel again. I really hope to keep posting, start to post M3 battle reports again, and I really hope to that people will enjoy it and hopefully even drain more people to it again.
Yeah, and I'm going to have a link to Andreas's channel here in the show notes. I can tell you guys that the stuff that he did put out is really, really good, and put you on the spot, man. I would love, and trust me, nobody gets it better than I do as far as the pressure of real life and, you know, trying to put this together. And I do think that people appreciate just how much time it takes to do it and to do it well. I would really love to see some more from you. So if you can find the time, man, I am a huge fan of the material that you put out and would love to see more. So you've got me waiting for you. And then now the pressure's on because your link is going to be in the show notes and everybody's going to want to go over there and see some more. Victor, do you have anything you want to plug?
Nothing for myself, but I guess I'll plug the our local big tournament, which this was a part of. This tournament that we talked about was a part of. So basically, two times a year, our local game shop does a big tournament for both Malifaux, but also Warhammer 40K, Age of Sigmar, and War Machine, and sometimes some other smaller games as well. Next time will be in May, the 9th and 10th of May. So you're all welcome to come up here. It's usually a lot of people. We'll hopefully have more Malifaux people there, but in total, we'll always are for all of the games more than 100 people here. So it's
amazing.
Yeah, it's a great event.
I think it was about 150 this year.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big tournament. Usually like 100 40K players and then a bunch of other games.
Well, so your goal, Victor, is to turn that into 100 Malifaux players.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
tell them for a tenth of the price, they can play a better game.
That would be nice.
It would be. Yukim, do you have anything you want to plug?
I think I just want to give a shout out to our local henchman, Eric, who has been making... basically doing a huge job with making sure we have tournaments fairly regularly, and also trying to do a few of the things you mentioned, actually, trying to have more people show up to play at the game store, try to get new people to demo for new people, and to basically grow the Malifaux scene over here. So I just want to give a big thanks to him.
Yeah, the henchmen are so great. And every good meta has a good henchman that's really behind the scenes. But a little too often I hear people complain that, you know, the game's not really big, we don't have a henchman, our henchman doesn't do a whole lot. I would love to see the community take a little bit more ownership of growing the game themselves. And just one little thing that we really have made a point of doing here in in North Carolina. And it's why I think the North Carolina meta has grown the way it has is one, like I mentioned, playing in the stores, being visible. I mean, I used to host games all the time here on the third floor. I've got 8 tables set up on the third floor for Malifaux. And we used to come here and play a lot. But now we play at the stores for that visibility. The second thing is obviously not during a tournament, but when you're playing casually and somebody comes up and shows interest, stop playing for a second. Engage them, talk to them, let them know if they have any questions or they're wondering what's going on. I think one of the things that makes Malifaux special is we're unlike a lot of other tabletop games. And the type of people that play this game tend to be a little bit of a different mentality than, say, some of the other games out there. And if their first encounter, they walk over and they see pretty models on a table, two people having a lot of fun who then stop and seem welcoming, it can do a lot to change the game. Well, gentlemen, I hope this is not the last time I have you guys on the show. I really enjoyed this. I think, we want to hear more from your part of the world. The one last question I have, and Andreas, maybe you can answer this for me, is, you know, you kind of talked about the media that's out there, and, you know, it's pretty much dominated here right now in M3E, a lot of the U.S. Content coming out. I'd be curious to know, is there stuff that you hear about either the U.K. or the U.S. metas that seem odd or very different than what you see as far as the game in Sweden?
So the thing with the meta is like, it's so interesting. It's like one of the things I love to hear both from America and England, like the tournament wrap-ups that both Kyle and I and you do on your show it's so interesting to hear, because I, as many others, I love to crunch the numbers and see and try to see how things are turning and the differential, how it looks from the continents and different parts of the world. So for me, it have a really huge impact to see how different it is. And I also can see that only from the active faction groups we have on Facebook and how we're talking from person to person, how they experience different master and how they play. It's really interesting. Just this game in day two, I had a man walk over to me and said, like, I also faced the Molly play today, and she plays so different from how you did it. It was like a completely different master, even you play the same master, and that's so fun to hear. And I'm just so curious how their game went.
Yeah. It is really interesting to kind of hear the differences. Here in the U.S., we have huge differences just within the country, you know, because we're so spread out from each other. It's fascinating. And this comes back to what you and I already talked about, which is I'd love to hear some more voices out there so that we can learn more, because I love hearing how other people play the game. All right, guys, I want to thank everybody who was listening for sticking around. And gentlemen, until we talk again, thanks.
Thank you
for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Take care. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the US Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes. You guys are pros. That was good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's a bit of a nervous, nerve-wracking thing to
be
on this kind of recording.
The first time I was on a podcast, I got all nervous too. Just remember that, like, you know, like you forgetting Toshiro's name and stuff like that. I'll edit all that out. All right, guys. I was really hoping that we would be able to cover this far in the first hour, and we did, because I really want to spend a lot of time talking about just general stuff at the end. So cool. I appreciate the efficiency.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like there's a lot to cover, but I try to keep it short.
Yeah, I mean, when you start talking like, you know, activation to activation, you lose two-thirds of the people don't care, right? What they want to get is just a general sense of how the game went. And all three of you have done a very good job of, you know, saying this is what was significant and kind of, you know, here's something that's interesting or you can learn from. So you guys are doing a great job.
Yeah, this is going smoothly.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. That was going to be a good episode.
I realized I didn't really stick to the, like, suggested order of going through the games. Might have been a bit chaotic, I realize, but I hope it's okay.
Oh no, Yugumi, it was all good content, man. All good content. No, I think everybody covered what they needed to cover. No complaints at all.
Have you had any Watch Dogs games yet?
I have yet to play them, man. I've got I don't play unpainted models.
Yeah.
I have to stop taking commissions, because I just, my stuff isn't painted. And I've got a half a Lucius box. I got to paint for a guy. And that's still not done. I just got the Marvel game, and, just to take a break, I started painting Hulk. And now I just want to paint all of them, you know, because it's just new models and stuff. So unfortunately I there's no way he'll get painted this year. It's going to be probably spring before I have Unstuck painted.
The sad thing is, like, you do this for your love to the board game so much, but by doing this, you cut the time to do the thing you love.
Oh, no question. I mean, the podcast between recording and editing probably takes up 10 hours a week of my life.
Yeah. It's a lot of time.
Yeah, it is a lot of time. The dumbest thing I ever did was say I was going to put this out weekly. That was stupid. But
I also wonder, like, what happened with your battle reports?
So, and this is time. You know, it takes literally an entire day, like from like 10 a.m. to, you know, 10 hours to record one of those.
Now I'm back in.
And, hey, Victor. Hey. It takes about 10 hours to record them, and then it takes probably 30 hours to edit them. Mm. And now we have really are starting to get good at the live streams, and the live streams take 3-4 hours and there's no editing. So I'm sure we'll do another pre-recorded battle report at some point. But because of time, it's just those live streams are so much easier to do.